Good evening. Tonight we're just going to discuss chapter 16, which is called Three Kinds of Laziness. And actually it's very short. So we'll save talking about the paramitas till next time. So last week, we gave a brief introduction to the Lojong slogans. That was chapter 5. And there's a lot of them. They're listed in the back of the book. And on the whole, without some kind of commentary, most of them are not all that easy to understand. But for example, Tanglen is one of these. And we also talked very briefly last time about all dharmas agree at one point. So we'll be getting back to that a little bit. But mainly last time, the topic was called the five strengths. Hello, come in, join us. Your spot there. Oh, always come in.
Always come in.
So last week we went through a chapter called Strength, and it had a list of five strengths, which we don't need to review really, but the names of them were strong determination, familiarity, seed of goodness, reproach, and aspiration. So having talked about strengths, it makes some sense to talk about laziness. They're opposite sides of something or other. But let's step back for a moment. What are we doing here, and why do we go through things that have lists and details and discuss them? Or more precisely, is it possible to get all this down to a single point, rather than study so many different things? And the answer is, actually it is, but to realize that would take some effort, but effort which we can actually do. And that effort is summarized by all dharmas agree at one point. What is that one point? Anyone want to venture that? No, not in the book. What is that? Okay, well, you weren't here, but welcome back. Okay, the one point is non-self. That's basically what Buddhism has to teach. And there are lots of things that it has to teach, but basically every one of them is non-self. So all dharmas agree on one point. Another way of phrasing this, all the Buddha's dharma converges on a single point. This was said by Trangu Rinpoche. So I'm going to read you a paragraph of what he wrote, but do we all understand the word dharma? Okay, dharma. Well, it's not easy to understand, but the definition of it actually can be understood in two ways. Dharma can mean the teachings of the Buddha. So all the teachings of the Buddha and all the teachings of realized teachers who have commented and explained it and restated it in many different ways are called Dharma. To study the teachings is called Dharma. And there are said to be 84,000 of them, which is a lot and more than anyone can learn in a lifetime. But then Dharma has another meaning. It can mean the phenomenal world. It can mean reality, that which actually is. And if we understand that, then we don't have to understand anything else. But we tend to see it in a distorted way. We tend to see it from a point of view of self. And that is not understanding the world as Dharma. So if we actually see the world as it is, that also is Dharma. Seeing the phenomenal world is Dharma, and it teaches us everything. I'm going to read what the beginning of just the paragraph of what Thongu Rinpoche has to say, explaining all the Buddha's Dharma converges on a single point. But I'm going to put the whole thing up on our website. It's worth reading. The first instruction is that all Dharma, all the teachings of the Hinayana and Mahayana, have one common purpose: to reduce or eliminate the clinging to a self. Whatever Dharma we practice, whatever mind training we meditate on, the purpose is to diminish that clinging. If our clinging doesn't diminish, then our practice isn't working properly. If we notice that the continual thought of ourselves as important is decreasing, it is one sign that mind training is working. So actually, there are quite a few slogans that deal with this, but everything, every technique then is about not cherishing the self and putting others before the self. So the point is non-self. From the Buddha's perspective, there is no self. So if there is no self, then there's no problem. Really simple. But we don't see it that way. One teacher who wrote who actually we listed on our website, Anam Thubten, wrote a book called No Self, No Problem. And a lot of what he teaches has to do with getting a sudden glimpse of what that could mean. But just saying there's no self doesn't help us at all. How does the Buddha see us? Well, so the Buddha sees no self, and if the Buddha was out there, that would be absolutely useless to us. If there's someone out there who's the Buddha and he says, well, I don't see a self, it would be of no help to us. The only reason that could be a help is because we are the Buddha. We all have Buddha nature. We're trying to awaken it. And perhaps at some time or other we get a little glimpse of it. But most of the time, all us ordinary sentient beings don't get it. So all these teachings, all these trainings are described from our point of view. Basically, we feel we have a self, right? Everyone feels I have a self, and there are other selves, and myself, I feel, has a problem, or some problems, or many problems. I definitely feel I have a self. So these teachings, these trainings, are for people who feel they have a self. We don't have to see it from the Buddha point of view to start to work with them. They're completely practical. So has anyone ever seen a sign? It's not a bumper sticker, but it's a sign I've seen in an office, and it goes, well, you may think you have problems, but yours are only happening to you, whereas mine are happening to me. So that makes the essential point, I think. We feel we have a self. So what are these trainings doing? They're practices in turning our view of the self upside down. Not just saying, well, there's no self, but they're causing us a lot. If we actually do these trainings, they're trainings in how to disrupt our thinking, how to disrupt our habitual patterns of putting ourselves before others. So all these trainings are troublemakers, right? Drive all blames into one. What are some of the others that we've dealt with? Well, Tonglin, take in what we don't want and give out to everyone else what we really want, what we'd like to hold for ourselves. Very disruptive. The immeasurables, the four immeasurables, are disruptive practices. They go against what we really would like to do, to hold on to ourself. So, from our point of view, it takes a lot of effort to do something like practice five strengths or overcome three kinds of laziness. From our point of view, it seems like a lot of effort, which is questionable from the Buddha's point of view, but there we have it. It takes a lot of work, or at least it seems to. So getting back to this chapter, it talks about three kinds of laziness. I'm not going to really follow very much of what's in the book, but the three kinds of laziness. Did anyone read it? And can okay, what would one of them be?
Comfort orientation.
Comfort orientation, right? Thank you. What do we understand by that? Why is that a form of laziness?
It's when we're always in our comfort zone and not given the opportunity to grow.
Yeah, right. If we stay in our comfort zone, it's an excuse for not growing, for not opening, right? And what's another one?
Loss of heart.
Loss of heart, or faint-heartedness. And this is a big one. We may feel we want to work on the environment of the planet, but it seems absolutely helpless, hopeless. The powers ranged against us are so immense that we can't get a grip on it. Or we want to help people, but there are so many of them that need help. There are great bodhisattvas in the past, great warriors, brave warriors who vowed to save all sentient beings. And they were powerful, but still, there's lots of misery, there's lots of suffering, and it seems absolutely hopeless to overcome that. So we get discouraged. So that's faint-heartedness. How could I even make a dent in this big mess? What's the last one?
Couldn't care less.
Couldn't care less. Indifference, yeah. Okay, so I think that often comes about when we're very, when we're exposed to suffering, and it's in our face, and we feel we can't do anything about it. So what do?
Block it out.
Yeah, block. We just harden ourselves and say, "That's not my problem. There's too much of that. I can't relate to that." So we have three kinds of laziness, and then we have lots of things we do to avoid changing our habitual laziness. We can engage in self-deprecation. I don't have the power to do anything about that. I'm too weak to possibly make a difference. Self-justification. I'm important. I can't be bothered with that. It's not my fault. It's someone else's fault. Well, that's just the circumstances. That's the way it worked out. There's nothing I can do about it. Or we can just plain ignore it. Plain go about our business. Keep busy. Find entertainment, and just avoid the contact, right? We have all sorts of different strategies. So what is the recommended antidote in this chapter? Did anyone note that? What did Pema say? Not resisting what?
Resistance.
Staying with our resistance, right?
Yeah.
Instead of finding an escape, staying with the experience of whatever our habitual pattern, whatever our resistance is, taking note of it, feeling it, being with our own resistance. So it's worth noting that just to be able to do this is difficult. And a very important reason why we are so insistent on daily practice is because holding our mind is about the only way we can try to stay with it. It's having a practice is about the only chance we get to notice our resistance when it comes up, let alone to not get diverted immediately, but to feel it. So our practice sets up a sort of alarm system in our mind so that we might actually be mindful enough and brave enough to hold on to it. And our practice tells us that we're able to hold our seat and stay. But now what about all dharmas agree on one point? Is that helpful here? How does that work? We have we have strengths, we have these three forms of laziness. We see our resistance. When we see all the different forms of resistance, what are they?
If you have no self, you have no laziness.
Yeah, say it louder.
If you have no self, you have no laziness.
If you have no self, you have no laziness. Okay.
I don't know how else to relate them.
Well, no, you know, I mean, that's... Yeah, if there's no self, then there's no laziness. That's the way the Buddha sees it. Okay. From our point of view, if there's resistance, it's because we're self-centered, right? In other words, everything we could do is I can't be bothered, or I'm inadequate, or it's not my fault, it's someone else's. Whatever the story is, whatever the resistance, they're all stories about myself and other, holding on to me. So if we actually could get that one point, then all the others we can just read from the world. We wouldn't even need to study. So that's the meaning of all dharmas agree at one point. Does that make sense? Is that more than just theory? That everything we're practicing, yeah. Say something, please.
Oh, it's just, I haven't been here in a while, and it's hard for me. I guess I worked my whole life to feel like I had a self. So that's hard. I felt like I just sort of, as a person, I had been obliterated and squished so much, like I wasn't a real person. I just had collected pieces of other people. So I had a real struggle. I was, a professional dish rag. And so for me, to work so hard to feel like I exist, really, I'm wondering if it's good for my mental health, to go with it. To let that go, I'm not. It does feel undoable for me right at this moment. But it's.
Well, that's such an important thing. So, thank you so much for bringing this out. So, we're all brought up in different ways, right? Some of us feel. Because of the way we were brought up, I have a very competent, good self that's going to succeed, and others feel I'm a rotten, miserable wretch of a self. I'm a failure, right? So all of these are workable, and yes, from a psychological point of view, if something is dysfunctional, then one needs a self that functions. And no one's suggesting here in any of these teachings that we want to make our sense of self dysfunctional. So that's a very important point to understand. What we're doing is seeing that there's something illusory about having a bad self, or a good self, or a successful self, or a disintegrated self.
Does this to attachment? Because when I was mentioning, I was actually remembering and sort of being grateful to the guy or whoever broke into the house that when I lived in Dorchester and sort of stole jewelry and stuff, because I was in my 20s and I got to the point of saying, I don't want to acquire things that I'm going to care about if they get stolen. Which is a kind of an odd approach, but there's a freedom in that. And
well, yeah, but is that the way you want to do it? I mean, this came up before, right? Like, if I love, I could lose what I love. Does this mean I should not find love, right? We've looked at this question. No, it means we should dare to be open to love. There's nothing wrong with acquiring jewelry or having a good job if that is something that's within your capability. There's nothing wrong with being successful, being respected. And there's nothing wrong with feeling that the self you managed isn't what you want. So We're going beyond. Yeah.
It's just Emily. So it is. Well, it's so confusing. I mean, I say, well, there's no self. But I feel like I have a self. I mean, I think everyone feels like they have a self. So, what does it really mean when we say no self? What is that about?
Yes.
From my perspective, I see it as the collective. When I think of not having myself, I mean, I have myself, but I feel it's an addition. If I'm open and I can let that in, then I feel as if I am part of everybody. So it feels self.
Let what in? The
if I let others in, if I let that openness, then I feel connected to everybody. Then I feel I have less feeling of loneliness. I feel more. I'm not explaining this well. But it doesn't feel that there is as much of a separation between the other. It suddenly feels that there's a connection that is beyond, you know, oh, this is my house, this is your house, you know, kind of thing. Feels like a community apart. Does that make sense?
Yes, but I think one of the things that has happened is we're starting kind of on a tier, if you will have it. I mean, it's a very noble path. But it's based on some work that was done in the earlier phases, which I need to explore in order to understand how this works, which is fundamentally that the notion of a self or the belief in a self is the source of our fundamental suffering. And this is shared by all beings. The idea that someone really is there who's exists and who's solid and who's permanent is a source of enormous confusion. What we do in the earliest foundations of Buddhism, which we're really not, we're already into the kind of the second turning.
Second level.
It's called the second turning, actually.
That's correct.
The first turning is about no self, fundamental, the Four Noble Truths, which we very briefly introduce. They actually are things that we don't want to ever take too much for granted and think we got it under our belt, because they're in our face continuously, and everything you say is a perfect expression of that fundamental humanity that you have right now, that you experience and are, and share with everyone else. And it is a state of basically bewilderment and confusion. Owning up to that is a very important point. Actually accepting the truth when we actually see it, we actually understand. We see it in different ways, and different circumstances cause these things to occur. But the training is learning how to actually trust yourself and come to an understanding of what we have is fundamentally positive. And we learn this by actually being able to see the truth. And that's our truth. It belongs to everybody, but it's also something we can know for ourselves.
So, several acres in my head to, you know, figure. I did just figure one thing.
But that's the process of meditation. Is the process of there goes that egg beater and there goes that egg beater. But pretty soon you see there's actually space in between the egg beaters, and there's actually a gap within that. So that's our first glimpse, that there's a possibility that things aren't quite so solid. So I think that's the way in that we're taught as the beginning. And Michael's right in terms of we kind of jumped over the first step in a way, which in a way puts us all at a disadvantage. But on the other hand, I think it was great that we launched into these teachings of generosity and open heart and the Mahayana path. But we will go back and start exploring these fundamental questions that really lay the ground for being able to more fully understand what we're going into at this point, even though we're just sort of touching the surface of this material in a way.
So just one question there about dissolving a boundary of self and other. Is not it. In other words, actually getting confused and losing the boundary, trying to dismiss our loneliness by becoming one of a glob, is not terribly realistic and not what we're talking about. Our boundaries are not annihilated, rather we see that they're a form of delusion that we have and that everyone else has. We're seeing through it rather than destroying it.
To the aspirations, because the aspirations seem to begin with the self, from what I'm remembering, may I experience and extend it. So that does seem like there's an acknowledgement of self, but going beyond into being self as part of all, is that?
Well, it's actually, that's right, but it's also inseparable from your own fundamental potential. And you have, and what we're learning how to train in is faith in our own potential as Buddha nature. One of the ways that this is understood, this teaching, is to understand that we all have these enlightened genes. We're all born, everybody innately has this fundamental capacity to be awake, to be completely sane. And this sanity is not something that's somewhere out there. It's actually in us directly. Our meditation practice is what helps us begin to get in touch with this. And when we do, as we do, we begin to stabilize with it, and we begin to allow it to come through. When this comes through, when they're talking about all these slogans about getting out of the way, the fundamental nature, which we all share with each other, comes through unimpededly. That is enlightened activity. Does that make sense?
I think so.
And so our aspirations, both for ourselves to grow in this path and to help others and benefit others, are inseparable. In fact, the distinction we have between working on the first level of egolessness, or another word is identitylessness. It's not like nobody's here. You know, it's not like this is all, I mean, we could say this is all a dream on some level, but practically speaking, we don't function that way. But, you know, when we actually start creating this identity issue, that's when it becomes a problem. I mean, identityless is another way of understanding egolessness. When we don't have to worry about an identity, we're completely present. And being present is being available. It's being available to the moment, whatever arises in it, how to interact with others, or how to be alone. And it's all good. We begin to actually understand this fundamental goodness. It's not only that we have a part of us that's good, it's all good.
I'm feeling like there's perhaps a semantic thing here, where, because of, and again, I'm not really good at all the terms yet, but like if you're talking about the seed or the bodhicitta as something that's inside and sort of in our core, to me that part would be what I would call self. And so, and I'm thinking that self may be sort of like something that we put on in this kind of a context. I'm not quite sure.
Yes, so we could talk about going beyond our small self to awaken to a greater self. That's language used by a lot of spiritual traditions, right? And that's what you're talking about. And if it's understood in the same way, then it's the same thing. The question is it understood in that way? Everything can be misunderstood.
Absolutely.
So we have to be, we'll work on all these things. Even hope.
Wondering if some of what it feels, because I certainly hear what you're saying, because all these things that we've been hearing about building up self-esteem and feeling like we can do it, and it feels like we're...
Well, there's some confusion there, because we're not cutting down self-esteem. We're cutting down an identity of I'm a this and I'm a that. Because let's say you identify 100% with your job, and then you lose your job. So where's the self in all that? So I think it's looking more deeply at the ways we define ourselves. Those things, how solid are they, really? You know, today you're walking, tomorrow you had a car accident, and you're no longer a person that can actually move. You know, it could be anything.
I worked in a state hospital, you know, different state hospitals my whole life, so I'm aware that all we have is this, I feel all we have is this moment, and all we have is each other, because mm-hmm. everything can be taken. And I've seen people who've had it all taken. And I don't know, I'm wondering, like, with sort of like, I feel like with what, similar to maybe what Mary said, I mean, I can feel better if I feel like I'm, or I'm more comfortable with the no self. If I feel like I'm part of the universe, and I like feeling part of the universe, but maybe...
Well, they're the same. That's the point. As opposed to being a fragment, you know, some kind of little atom that sparked off that's isolated and just simply floating in space. We are inseparable. I mean, this kind of... So when we come to this point, we actually understand we actually share the same primordial ground. And the teachings will take us to that point of understanding how we can be introduced to this and become more profoundly connected with what we are already, which is an inseparability.
Dimitri, you know, yeah. A key fellow, he talks about how we actually all are made of stardust.
Are what?
Made of stardust.
We're all made of stardust, mm-hmm. to some
okay.
extent.
Mm-hmm.
No stardust in it. Which is kind of a nice thing to make a little more comforting than the no self. Which just seems like I want to, you know, call the psychiatrist. Please help. Take me away from these people.
Well, but you showed up on your own, don't you?
This is a radical approach, but when you discover the fundamental reality beyond self, it's like there's a tremendous peace that you discover at that time. It's not like you suddenly feel really lonely and, oh my God, you know, not only do I not have a self. I mean, existentially, that's the case. We do feel alone. We have to learn how to be able to be alone and accept ourselves as we are, but at the same time, living in an egoless dimension means completely being open and at peace, because there's no war, no problem about creating or feeling accepted or rejected by others, which would also put us in a state of distress. There's nothing to get us distressed about, because this is an unconditioned state. You know what I'm saying? It's not based on somebody liking or disliking, being treated well or badly, having a good experience or a bad experience.
I think we need to get back to what we're feeling right now rather than some ultimate point of view in order to recover the discussion.
I'm fucked.
No. So we should make it very clear that...
And that's okay. Because
what?
I think ultimately we all are.
Fine.
No, but I don't like to feel that. I sort of try to focus my day not focusing on that.
On what? Not focusing on what?
The fact that we're all screwed. I mean, we all...
Wait a minute. No one's... Self-deprecation is not what this is about, okay?
No, I
don't
mean
it's the opposite. Well, self-deprecation is a form of insisting I have an identity.
It seems like what you're trying to get at, I hate to use the term because it's cliche, a type of middle path, and straying from that middle path in the sense of laziness. There are lazinesses that go off into obsession in one direction and go into in the opposite direction. It's sort of, it's as much of a problem to say, define yourself as this or that, as it is to say, I am not this, I am not that. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, I think I understand somewhat what you're trying to say, where, if you go up, it's not good if you do this sort of thing, you have to be careful there, but also that doesn't mean you should do the thing and go up in the other direction.
Yeah, right, so there's that's a very good point, the middle way.
One other thing that I know, the level they're talking about, it would take me decades to go, that feeling like I'm part of bringing people, I'm part of a community and things like that. But one simple way I look at the self is, we all maybe have a job or whatever we do, but when we come home, we become dad. Then you go to somewhere just because a stranger. And so we're not like whatever, professor or doctors or engineers or whatever, we're not always like that. So we don't have if we think this way, that, when we're talking to our friends, we're just friends. And we're talking to my son, it's like I'm the dad. I'm not like my job, whatever it is, mm-hmm. like that. So, that way you don't feel always that I'm big, I'm powerful, and things like that.
That's exactly the point. Yeah, thank you. That's just what we're talking about, exactly. Yeah.
But this is probably in a higher level than me, that thinking about I'm part of,
Well, let's not say we can pretend that then.
It's hard to think, because we can be very comfortable here, but when we go to work, and all this little envy and jealousy and competition that comes, then it's difficult. So the reality is to feel that kind of mental state is probably going to take over for me. For people take that.
But when you're at work, you're there, and you're relating to the situation in context of what it is. When you go home, you're relating to your son. When you're speaking on the phone to a friend, you're a friend. You're really where you are. And if nothing is holding you back from really being there, then you can find a way to work with the situation and understand it. Yes?
Yes.
I mean, there's nothing more that we need to do. It's not like we're supposed to go somewhere else.
Okay, so we're not going somewhere else. So here we are with our feeling of me and my problems. You have your problems, but they aren't happening to me. And
little do you know.
So we're doing exercises in disturbing our putting ourselves first, right? So we could keep it pretty simple. Our awareness tells us that we're always centered on this idea of me, and it's most important. And here we're given practices that frustrate it, hard practices. So that's what these practices are really about. And all dharmas agree on one point, is making exactly that point, that whatever whatever's going on, if we can start to decentralize that simply by putting others first, and seeing that over time we start to put others first more, this is a progressive practice, not a matter of seeing some absolute point of view and being enlightened. That's sudden enlightened experiences can happen, but that's not these practices. These are starting from right where we are now and turning our behavior and our habits upside down. It's actually powerfully changing how we behave, and I think that's the essential point. We're doing practices to change how we use our mind and how we think of self and other. We're reversing it. To say that they don't exist is a more transcendental thing. But to start to reverse it is an actual step we can take right now. Is that...
I love this book that I... audio book I read about the Hobbies. You know, one of the Buddhist monks, also Matthew Carr.
Mm-hmm.
He talked about that, you know, practice. You don't expect to learn anything if you don't practice. I mean, that was an interesting book that I thought was very helpful. Mm-hmm. To understand that you need to practice. You just don't. You all had starting point, but, you know, we're on different level, but you have to start from where you are.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
He's a wonderful author, I think.
Mm-hmm.
He's also been a translator for the Dalai Lama, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Kensei Rinpoche.
He would Kensei Rinpoche's main translation.
Matthew Ricard. It's a French.
Matthew
Ricard.
Matthew Ricard.
French.
R-I-C-A-R-D.
Okay. Right. He's really wonderful to read. He grew up in France and had a brilliant career in biology, I think, yes?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually gave that up to become a monk.
Mm-hmm.
And he and his father wrote a very interesting book. I forget what it's called.
It's called Monk and Philosopher.
The Monk and Philosopher, yeah. It's a wonderful father and son dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
They both wrote alternate chapters.
Well,
anyway,
I think the reason also that we discover, I mean, we're each on our own path. And we can hear these concepts and teachings, but they don't really mean too much until we discover them on our own,
mm-hmm.
which is a very different type of learning. It's a very different type of learning. So what happens in the meditation practice and how it informs our study is, so when we meditate and we have all these thoughts and then we come back to our breath, and we notice these gaps, then there's actually a training that's happening. The more we come back to the present moment and drop the storyline, that gives us the ability in daily life situations when things come up not to respond quickly or react, really. I guess that's another way to talk about it. React versus respond. That there's more space in the situation because you've worked with your mind in such a way that it's tamed in some way. So therefore, you could hold the space open and allow whatever's happening to be there before you kind of jump in or before you cut someone off or respond in anger or whatever. That space is there.
Hmm.
Yes.
Is it perhaps something like when the self, in a sense, may be the storyline?
Mm. Yeah, the self. Oh, exactly.
Absolutely.
The self is the self that we're saying is illusory is our storyline. Yeah,
right.
that's fine. Okay,
right.
That's a good way. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Right, and you're responding from whatever that little piece of story that comes up at the moment that's the hook. So it's almost like Velcro. Someone's presenting something and it hooks
mm-hmm.
your storyline right to it. And then all of a sudden you're stuck together and it's this painful situation.
So,
or it could be attachment and you could be magnetized or
right.
seduced by it because you find someone who's really comfortable to, you know, choose to project with and find this cozy zone that you can
mm-hmm.
absorb. But, you know, that could, you know, even if it seems to be pleasurable, it's fundamentally problematic. And eventually it won't work because, you know, at some point you're going to realize that you're going to change. the other person's going to change, and those little things that are holding that fabric together will come apart.
So I would like to conclude by explaining how I didn't get it, basically. So I found my teacher, Chogyam Trungpa. I felt I was quite devoted. Perhaps I was more fascinated. But I understood I should do practice, so I did plenty of practice. I had a job and other things, but I felt if I maybe got up early and did 2 hours of practice and then went about my day, that somehow or other that was going to start to work. It took a while for me to see, not just see, but hear what he was saying. And somewhere there was a phrase, something like, no vacation from wakefulness. And I began to think, well, what does that mean? I'm doing my practice, but then that's over. Now I want to go do something else. I want to go and relax, or I want to just get absorbed in my job or whatever. What does this mean? There's no vacation from wakefulness. No vacation from the light going on. It started to seem incredibly claustrophobic to me, frightening, terrifying, that there'd be no place to hide, no place to hide from what he was expressing and demanding. No corner to get where I could escape it. And I began to see that what I was asking for was, well, this is Dharma. This is something else that I do.
Separation.
Yeah, no separation. So what does that mean? Hopefully it doesn't mean there's no time to relax and enjoy myself. That's not what it means. But if we're working and the work is very interesting, that's still something we could be wakeful about and see our fascination. In other words, the Dharma can still be there. Now, I'm not saying I can do that. My mind just forgets it for a while. But that's the aspiration. There's nothing that... There's no corner of your life that you can hold private, in a sense, from the light going on in your own mind. You can't say, getting into an argument is something over there. That's a different matter. Or just being in a restaurant and having good company and having good food and drink, well, that's a vacation from being wakeful. Or making love is something else. That's a vacation from being wakeful. So he was basically asking for the light to be on all the time. And it seemed to me awfully claustrophobic. And I don't think I get it yet. But there comes to be a certain point. There's a certain tipping point where you really want that, where you don't, instead of saying, well, I want to put the Dharma here and have this here, you say, I really aspire to have Dharma all the time in my life. There are people who actually get to this by other spiritual paths also, or just their own state of wakefulness. But there it is. This is a tipping point where what I want is, what I really want is to let wakefulness be there all the time, for there to be nothing under the rug. And I haven't done that, but I clearly aspire to it. So when we actually come to see that we want that, we start to get a glimpse at this point that it's not as much effort as it seems. Yes, it seems like it takes a lot of effort, but we might actually see that we put far more effort into the recycling of our samsaric existence, our path of responding inappropriately, our path of operating with the light out and creating further pain, that just doing that is much harder work than giving in to being enlightened. And if we get even a glimpse of that, then we've reached the point of making some sort of commitment, which doesn't go away. And that's awfully important. When we start this meditation, we use the four dharmas of Gampopa. Everyone's heard it by now? Are there people who come in late who've never heard it? Grant your blessings so that my mind may be one with the Dharma. Grant your blessings so that Dharma may progress along the path. Grant your blessings so that the path may clarify confusion. Grant your blessings so that confusion may dawn as wisdom. So that's a whole path. But what I'm talking about is just the first line. Grant your blessing so that my mind may be one with the Dharma. That's the tipping point that allows us to enter. And if we've done that, we can't run away anymore. At that point, we see that all dharmas agree on one point, which is non-self, and that's the only way we can go. So that's the end of my last card here. So, is there more to be said?
I want to go back to what Roberta was saying about how, with the whole non-self thing and being able to build up yourself, what kind of steered me away from Buddhism for a long time is the idea of not having a self seem to be very like nihilistic and obliterating. But the way I've kind of think of it now, and correct me because maybe this is totally wrong, is let's say that I wake up tomorrow and I've realized the truth of reality and I've become enlightened magically. It doesn't mean that...
Wait.
Let's say I wake up tomorrow morning and I understand the truth of reality and I'm enlightened and I just like had one of those moments, right? It doesn't mean that my favorite fruit is not still going to be strawberry. I'm still going to be like me, but I will be me, but open to the understanding of the rest of the world. So maybe my favorite fruit is still strawberry, but maybe like now it's a stupid example, like my favorite fruit could also be pineapple because I can understand that and I can experience it from a different possibility. It's not like getting rid of yourself, it's like adding on to yourself, using self loosely here. Like, does that make sense? Is that a legitimate...
Is it adding on to the...
Not adding on as so much as like...
No.
It's,
wait, just wait a second, please.
Yourself isn't so strongly defined anymore.
Therefore... first of all, if you have such a marvelous experience,
it's not gonna happen, but yeah,
that's very good. Okay, it could give you some real insight, but it's gonna go away too. Okay, it can serve. One glimpse like that can give you motivation for a long time. You can get a lot of mileage out of that little glimpse, but you have to not try to keep producing it.
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that, like, things about... Just because you realize this thing doesn't mean that certain things still aren't true. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so you've gone beyond yourself. So you still enjoy strawberries.
Yes.
That's not going to go away.
Yes, exactly.
Okay? But if you don't have a strawberry, that's okay, too.
That's okay, too. Because
there's more equanimity. There's more openness to everything that could happen.
Yes, that's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, okay.
There's nothing nihilistic about...
I think a lot of people interpret that
wrongly. Yeah, of course.
And especially when you're talking to people who come from like a background of trauma or mental illness, the idea of non-self is very nihilistic and scary to them, and I think the topic of that has to be approached with caution in some way.
Right, because the sense of one's presence needs to be healed.
Right.
Yes.
People are suffering from a woundedness, which can occur for various reasons, and for real, genuine reasons. It's not like, that's just where you start from. You're working with what you have, and you realize that you need to discover wholeness. We all have discovered. The sense of wholeness is not about having a self, about a big ego. Ego is not wholeness. Ego is fragmentary. That's the difference. I think, you know, this is something we can actually find out. How many people are talking in my mind right now, you know? And are they actually agreeing with each other? Do they even know that the other person's really there when they're sort of taking over the speaker system? As you were talking about egg beaters, you know? the tapes that we hear playing. And the whole idea that what happens with our meditation practice is that as we simply are allowing ourselves to be, which is really what this is about, we simply are allowing ourselves to be. And the space that Emily brought up, the space that you begin to discover, which is simply present and between the thoughts. And it's not about the thoughts. It doesn't matter. There's a sense of peacefulness that's fundamentally there for us to discover. That's why the fourth noble truth is peace. The first noble truth is suffering. And then we have the causes of suffering, and then we have a possibility of working with the suffering, of actually gaining the path to get through it and get beyond it. And but the fourth noble truth, which is not emphasized a lot, is peace. And so that's part of what this discovery is. So it's not like you're miserable because you have no self. It's like you're fundamentally relieved. You know, it's like this. In fact, it's often described as liberation, because you're not encumbered by all of these issues around being me and the stories that we have about either having a problem or not having a problem. But at the same time, if we have psychological or emotional or physical damage, you know, whether it's to our body, speech, or mind, I mean, these are things that need to be addressed and they need to be worked on and absolutely respected. And that's part of our path, too. We don't have to only wait. Well, wait till I get this done, and then I'll do that. The understanding about this, we can do it now. We can actually bring this material, our experience, to the path right now, and that's what's so fundamentally available about it and good about it, because we don't have to wait to prepare and do 15 things before we can actually stop and be really in the moment as it is.
And I think I was just thinking, if there's another point here, which is, if you leave here tonight feeling confused, that's okay too. And a lot of this past is being confused and wondering and questioning and chewing on it and thinking about it and asking questions. So it's not like you're spoon-fed, this is the way it is, here's the answer, believe this, or else. I mean, it's really about figuring it out for yourself and understanding it for yourself. That's the root of the whole thing. So there are lots of different ways into understanding things. So sometimes a book you read or a different teacher, all sorts of things will help us find a clarity there.
My sense is I'm going to have to go through and reread, you know, I'm like getting what we call the awareness level first. And it's not going to fully sink in until multiple exposures.
Well, it takes a long time.
And also the practice in conjunction with it, you see. So that's the more you practice. I mean, I've had experiences of reading a book, and then later I read it again, and I go, oh, my gosh, I didn't know that was in there. You just never, you don't read it, you don't see it. It doesn't move off the page because it doesn't mean anything to you until you've had some practice behind. So patience, I guess.
Emily.
Yes.
Was that other announcement about meditation instruction?
Yes, thank you for bringing that up. So I just wanted to, some people weren't here last week, so I'll keep making these different announcements over and over. But it's really great as you start practicing to meet with a meditation instructor. So it's Michael, and me, your choices. And you can pick anyone you like. And it's really helpful, I think, to meet with someone and talk about your practice and what's going on for you, because everyone has different things that they're working on, and we don't really address all that in a group situation. It's really helpful to have a one-on-one. So if you can write to info@walthambuddhist.org, that comes to me, and you can start with asking questions to me, or you can address any of us in terms of finding someone to work with. And it's totally voluntary. There's no cost, and you decide what you need and what you want.
And it's not psychotherapy. It's not. It's not confession.
No.
It's not. And it's not a whole lot of different things. Its focus is meditation, but it will not take you into different life situations as is appropriate in the situation. But there's no sense of having to come up with your life history or your personal problems if that is not germane to what you're seeking. It can include suggestions for reading. Meditation is just a simple instruction. Is not the same for everyone all the time. And we can't accommodate that in a group situation, and we can privately. So we encourage that. Yeah.
And also, there's flyers back there on a teacher who's coming to Cambridge. So I actually haven't met him, but I saw him in a movie that we're going to be showing, actually, in a couple weeks. You might want to pick up one of those flyers. And there's also a list back there I mentioned for ordering meditation cushions. So that's another reason, if you don't know what you might want, to meet with one of us, and we can help you with the right type. So any other questions?
Should we pass out the...
it's down there.
It's down here, okay. The dedication of merit.
Mm-hmm.